Are you ready to proceed, Mr. Storm?
Yes, I am.
You may.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, I'm Paul Storm on behalf of Juvie and Mr. Fairclough. The court's order in judgment that the 375 patent is unenforceable for inequitable conduct must be reversed, and this court render a decision that inequitable conduct did not occur, or the plague of inequitable conduct charges in litigation and the flood of documents into the patent office, which a Theracense decision is intended to curtail, will continue.
The district court judge here found that there was a but-for relationship, which is precisely what Theracense requires. So where did it fall short on the materiality question?
The court's statement of but-for materiality is in its enforceability discussion, and it is not supported by the record. In fact, the court specifically found during the trial that he would not allow speculation on what would occur at the patent office and excluded evidence on that basis. So he does state in his opinion that his view that had Dronach been submitted, the claim wouldn't have issued, but that is not supported by the record. And further, here we know, because of the reexamination which is pending, that in fact no rejection was made of Claim 1 over Dronach after it was submitted to the patent office. So we do not believe that but-for materiality was in fact shown on this record, despite the court's statement to that effect.
Why is it appropriate for us to consider the reexamination?
It is a public record, number one, so you can take judicial notice of it. Number two, the patent office proceedings establish a time frame for when rejections are to be made, and that time has passed. The reexamination proceedings themselves are not over, and so the reexamination is not concluded, but the time for a rejection over Dronach has passed.
Why do you emphasize the part of the opinion that this finding of but-for materiality appears? It shouldn't matter where the judge makes the finding, should it?
Well, he makes a finding of high materiality under, you know, the pre-Theracense standard, and then when he is weighing the materiality and evidence of intent, he finds the evidence of intent is weak, and nevertheless finds the patent unenforceable and states his view in passing that the patent office would have rejected.
But we should give no weight to where he makes this finding, should we?
No, not really. I think it's simply not supported by the record. And of course here, the finding of intent to deceive is also not supported in the record. The record
isn't that your stronger argument?
We do believe that it is a stronger argument.
Materiality here is, I think, a difficult one for you.
But it is a closer call. There's no question about that. But we think there's really no question on intent to deceive. There's ample documentary evidence that Mr. Fairclough believed that what he had invented was an improved stroller that had a platform for a standing child, an older, heavier child, where the weight would be between the wheelbase. And that.
In that respect, the criticisms of Chronic that was disclosed are precisely addressed by Dronach.
They are not. The point I was making was,
well, it doesn't tip over. It's a freestanding platform. It strikes me that there's at least Dronach, at least to some degree, addresses exactly the concerns raised against the Chronic reference.
I believe you're referring to the Conniger reference.
Yeah, the Conniger. Yeah,
the names,
thank you.
Do kind of run together.
They do a bit for me.
There's also a Konar reference to keep us slightly confused there. Neither the Conniger reference nor the Dronach reference place the weight of the older standing child between the wheelbase of the stroller. And there is significant evidence that Mr. Fairclough believed that that was important. That evidence includes his own handwritten UK patent application prepared in his own words before he conferred with the patent attorney.
Yeah, that's a different reason why you might discuss Dronach, but at least the criticism of Conniger, the tipping aspect, is addressed by Dronach.
That specific problem with Conniger is addressed, and then when by Dronach, by having a third wheelbase at the end, and Mr. Fairclough explained both at trial and in his own contemporaneous notes why that was a separate problem. In other words, one problem went away and another problem appeared. In Conniger, you have a front and rear wheel and one wheelbase and a tipping problem. In Dronach, you have three different axles, two wheelbases, and different weights and loads, which he found unacceptable. And an important point here is we have contemporaneous notes from Mr. Fairclough where he analyzed Dronic and found it to be significantly different from his reference, from his invention. And he discussed the matter with his patent attorney. He discussed the matter with his licensee. He asked his patent attorney to get a copy from the Canadian Patent Office. I believe the record is clear that, number one, Mr. Fairclough did everything you would expect an inventor to do, including contemporaneously analyzing the reference and reaching his own conclusion that it was a material. And, in fact, Judge Ferguson stated at the Rule 50 hearing that the record was clear that Mr. Fairclough did not believe Dronic was material subjectively, and that he, Judge Ferguson, was troubled by whether it was a subjective standard or a should-have-known objective standard. And I think his statement on the record, that his analysis of the facts was that simply Fairclough believed himself that it wasn't material, answers the question of intent to deceive.
Well, that's a little, before you made the earlier statement about where the statement is found in the opinion, and you may disagree with the district court's findings on intent to deceive, but are you suggesting that they're not, that there's some ambiguity as to what the district court believed based on a statement he made to the parties during these proceedings?
I believe the juxtaposition of what he said in his opinion and what he said at the hearing shows that his opinion is based on incorrect law, that he used a should-have-known standard. That's stated explicitly in the opinion itself.
Of course, he was operating under a different law. TheraSense hadn't issued at the time, but he makes a pretty explicit finding of but-for materiality. Returning to the intent, part of the district court's intent finding relies on a jury's unique ability to discern intent.
Yes.
And that does seem to ring true. Can you address that?
Yes, I think there are two problems with that. Inequitable conduct is, of course, an equitable remedy. And we did object to being submitted to the jury and then didn't raise that issue on appeal.
He said it was advisory.
But more importantly here, we objected to the jury instructions on that question in which he explicitly instructed that intent could be found using a should-have-known standard. We believe that was not the law before TheraSense. We think Kingsdown was correct, and those panel opinions, which were not consistent with it and articulated a should-have-known standard, were in error.
But could they just as well have addressed the fact that Fairclough was pretty shaky when asked whether he'd sent Dronic to Harmon, his attorney?
That was
a pretty dicey sort of testimony there, and maybe the jury just said, that looks to us like intent.
First they were misinstructed. So ferreting out what they might have done if they'd been instructed properly is obviously not proper at this point. And his testimony about whether he gave the reference to his patent attorney was equivocal regarding whether he remembered sending it himself or whether his patent attorney had gotten it from some other source. There's documentary evidence, which is at A2362. This is a note from Mr. Fairclough to Babytran in which he notes that he has asked his patent attorney to obtain his own copy. And Fairclough was unequivocal that he had discussed the substance, that his attorney did have the substance in mind when they had discussions.
Doesn't the consideration of all of these factors require that we first take a look at the claim and the claim construction to see whether the claim construction was correct?
I don't really think you can get there because Mr. Fairclough's state of mind in 1996 would not be informed by a claim that hadn't even fully issued and certainly a claim construction which hadn't happened. And the question is, what was his state of mind at the time that he reviewed the reference? And the reference wasn't submitted to the patent office.
But how does one assess materiality without knowing the meets and bounds of the claim?
Well, but-for materiality requires looking at that. Okay, so whether the reference was in fact but-for material does require that. I thought you were asking me about Fairclough's state of mind.
No.
Okay, for the intent prong, I don't think that you can go into the claim construction because you have to know what the individual in question, in this case, an individual inventor, not a patent attorney at all, believed at the time when the patent hadn't even issued yet. And I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Storm. Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Trevor Carter. I, along with Dan Lechleiter, we're here today on behalf of Target Corporation. We believe that this court should affirm Judge Ferguson's finding of inequitable conduct because his opinion provides all of the factual findings necessary to find inequitable conduct under TheraSense. Judge Ferguson made a but-for finding of inequitable conduct.
But on the intent, it seems that he was influenced by the jury verdict. And is not your colleague correct that the jury verdict is something that's problematic for us to rely on post-TheraSense because it had an incorrect instruction?
Right. Judge Ferguson, in his opinion, made clear that he independently found intent. He looked at the jury as an advisory verdict, and he was very clear that that's all that it was an advisory verdict.
But he relies on it a solid paragraph there talking about how a jury is particularly sensitive to intent, and therefore he cites that as a factor in his finding. So isn't Judge Prost correct that we have to discount his finding a bit?
I don't believe so, because he independently found intent and laid out factual findings on his own and then noted that his findings of intent were consistent with that of the jury in the advisory verdict that they provided. The jury instruction also did note that the jury, to find intent, had to find that that was the single most reasonable inference. But in any event, it was just an advisory verdict. Judge Ferguson set out the law that he applied in the intent finding. The law that he applied was essentially the Star Scientific case. The basis for the intent law that is in the TheraSense decision. He knew that he had to find intent separate from materiality. And when you look at his opinion, he separately found intent different from materiality. He also identified that intent had to be the single most reasonable inference. And he went through and made detailed factual findings.
But what about, he also has to find that the applicant knew the reference was material. And that's a little weak, is it not? All we've got is a finding that somebody would have thought it was problematic, which is different than material, is it not?
Well, the factual findings that Judge Ferguson made, he started out with Conitor and the correspondence that Mr. Harmon, the UK patent attorney, and Fairclough shared on Conitor. Conitor was also an attachment, a platform attachment on a stroller. They knew that. And they found that to be problematic and questioned whether they would be able to obtain patent coverage in view of Conitor. Conitor sets the baseline for us. That document gives us an insight into the state of mind for both Mr. Fairclough and his UK attorney as to what it is that they believe would be material. They then received Dronic as part of a cease and desist letter. We know that Fairclough, in his own words, subjected it to severe scrutiny. The record is unclear whether Harmon received it, but we know that Fairclough at least subjected it to severe scrutiny. Having that knowledge, what then happened is that Mr. Fairclough and Mr. Harmon instructed their U.S. attorneys, who were also duped in this along with the U.S. Patent Office, instructed their U.S. attorneys, get us a patent on our crux of the invention, which is a child sitting, and behind that sitting child, another child standing on a platform. Mr. Harmon and Mr. Fairclough then sat back and watched as their U.S. attorneys, not knowing at all about Dronic, argued that two limitations, having a substantially unobstructed space above the platform and a substantially unobstructed trailing edge of the platform, that those two critical limitations resulted in them getting patents or in getting their patent. That's because what it is that the patent office has used at that time were strollers with baskets. Baskets that did not have a substantially unobstructed trailing edge, that did not have a substantially unobstructed space above. Dronic clearly teaches. In fact, it sets out the exact same problem. This reference that Mr. Fairclough subjected to severe scrutiny, he would have read the word platform in Dronic 30 times. He would have seen that she acknowledged the problem well before he did of an older child who doesn't want to sit in a stroller.
But why wouldn't Mr. Fairclough and Mr. Harmon see that Dronic is a trailer. It's not within the wheelbase of the stroller, and therefore discount it as something very different.
That is not consistent at all with what they said about Conagher. This would be a different case if we didn't have the insight into their state of mind on Conagher. Conagher was also an attachment platform that goes behind a stroller. And they found that to be very problematic and questioned whether they would be able to get a patent. That also had other problems. They said that in Conagher, it doesn't have a substantially unobstructed space above. That's a fact that they stated to the European Patent Office and a fact that is in the letter between Mr. Harmon and Mr. Fairclough. They noted that it was unstable. They talked about that the person pushing on Conagher wouldn't have enough room to move their feet. Those issues were all addressed in Dronic. So even though they found Conagher problematic, they identified issues with Conagher. Those issues they had with Conagher were overcome by Dronic. And Judge Ferguson, in his factual findings, to go back to your question, Judge Prost, about did they know it was material, the only reasonable inference here, based on their state of mind that we know of what they discussed about Conagher, is that they received Dronic, and as Judge Ferguson said, it was crystal clear that Dronic had to be disclosed. He said that if Conagher had to be disclosed, Dronic definitely did.
Can I ask you a process, hypothetical process question before your time runs out? And that is, you've got a conditional cross appeal here.
Yes.
With regard to validity. And so the view is that certainly if we reverse, that cross appeal comes alive. If we were to reverse the inequitable conduct finding. What about if we were to vacate and send back the inequitable conduct issue? Does your conditional cross appeal then become a real cross appeal, or do we have to wait until the judge revisits the inequitable conduct below, and only then does it become valid if it's ultimately reversed?
Yes, we believe that, number one, inequitable conduct should be affirmed, and you don't need to reach
this. No, I understand that. I said this is hypothetical. I don't necessarily believe it ought to be vacated and remanded. I'm just asking you hypothetically what would happen if that were the view.
Yes, then we believe that the court should address the cross-appeal on validity. And we believe that the cross-appeal on validity for anticipation, this comes down to...
But wouldn't that be an advisory opinion then? Because if we send the inequitable conduct back to the district court judge, it's quite conceivable he will ultimately find inequitable conduct. So wouldn't a decision on validity be advisory at this juncture?
Well, but if the court would reverse, and we believe that the evidence here compels a reversal of the validity finding, then the case ends on the validity finding, and you would not need a remand on inequitable conduct.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, I mean, the two are separate. So you're saying that you think inequitable conduct would disappear if there's validity? I mean, it's not necessarily so as a matter of law. It's so if that's what you want to pursue.
Right. If the patent is invalid, if claim one is invalid, that is the only claim at issue in this case.
But you're not asserting any argument that might warrant attorney's fees as an exceptional case or anything of that sort?
We did not raise that at the lower court.
So if we were to find that the patent is invalid, then that ends the issue with respect to inequitable conduct?
It ends the case, yes. On turning to invalidity, this court's de novo review of the single claim construction issue in this case results in anticipation. The term rear wheels is the limitation in the claim. The term rear wheels has several limitations in the claim itself, that the rear wheels are attached to the frame of the stroller. And looking at page 5 of our red brief shows a comparison of figure 2 of Dronic, which has always been agreed is covered by claim 1, and figure 2 of the Fairclough patent, which has always been agreed that is covered by claim 1 of the patent, and figure 2 of Dronic. when you look at those figures, you'll see the placement of the rear wheels in figure 2 of Fairclough are the same as the placement of the rearmost wheels in Dronach.
Well, let me ask you, though. So we're talking about anticipation here, not
yes.
obviousness. But are we compelled to reverse some of the district court's decisions on claim construction in order to reach it, to agree with you on anticipation? Doesn't that require a change in the claim construction?
We don't believe it requires a change in claim construction. We think even under the court's claim construction of rear wheels of the stroller, that the platform of Dronach, once it is attached, it is attached in a way that isn't easily removable. Dronach definitely teaches that it is attached in a permanent or semi-permanent way. It becomes part of the stroller. And the rearmost wheels then of Dronach, the back wheels on that
but
platform.
But Dronach itself refers to rear wheels and caster wheels and distinguishes them very clearly. The rear wheel is not the caster wheel.
Right. In Dronach, she refers to rear wheels as the wheels that are at the front of the platform, and the caster wheels are the rearmost wheels at the end of the platform. This court's case law is very clear that what something is referred to in prior art does not dictate how it is then read on a later patent here. So the fact that she used the terminology rear wheels in her patent does not in any way limit use of Dronach as prior art, that what she called the rear wheels are the only wheels that can be used as the rear wheels.
I see great wisdom in that rule when you're talking about terms that change with technology, but we're talking about technology that's as old as mankind here. Rear wheels are kind of understood, aren't they? And when you say mine is not a rear wheel, mine is a caster wheel, why doesn't that carry weight with this court?
Well, the claim just refers to rear wheels. It doesn't require any certain kind of wheel. There's no temporal limitation of when the rear wheel is added to the stroller. There's nothing that has to do about, you know, whether these rear wheels can accept brakes. The mistake that we believe that the district court made when it improperly used claim differentiation and required that the rear wheels be used with brakes and read that into
claim one. I know, well,
that's
why I was asking you about the claim construction, because don't we have to change, in order to agree with you, doesn't that require that we disagree with the district court judge on that claim construction point?
If you disagree with the court's claim construction ruling, then there is no dispute from appellants that Dronach anticipates and renders obvious. If you
disagree with the district court's claim construction as well.
We do. And if you agree with us that rear wheels means rear wheels, and the limitations on rear wheels are only those set out in the claim, that they are attached to the frame, and the rearmost wheels in Dronach are attached to the frame just as the rear wheels are in figure 2 of Fairclough, and if you agree that those rearmost wheels are mounted adjacent to the trailing edge of the platform, which they clearly are, those two limitations of rear wheels are clearly met by Dronach.
Okay, and if we agree with the district court's claim construction, then you still maintain that
the claim is anticipated because those rearmost wheels, once that platform is on, that becomes part of the stroller. Just because she referred to it as an attachment, once that attachment is on, it's now part of the stroller. Dronach was a device that was designed for that attachment. She talked about elongating the handle. Everyone at trial agreed she elongated the handle. She designed that stroller for it to work with that attachment. It's not an attachment that you can think of as something being flimsy, easily coming on and off. That attachment was on there. It was part of the stroller.
If I added the trailer to the back of my car, are the rear wheels of my car no longer the rear wheels? The rear wheels become the wheels on the trailer?
I think that is something that is different factually from what we have here. That is
because of the solidity of the attachment of the platform in Dronach?
Exactly. And whether the rear wheels are attached to the frame, which is a limitation on rear wheels in Claim 1. And you know, while somebody could get hung up on whether it's attached or directly attached, we can simply look at figure two of Fairclough and where those rear wheels are, figure two of Dronach, and see that the rearmost wheels are attached to the frame of the stroller in the exact same manner. I would like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
With respect to inequitable conduct, there's been some confusion in the questions and the discussion between documents about Conagher and documents about Dronach. The finding of inequitable conduct was based on the court's conclusion that there was an intention to deceive the patent office by a conscious decision not to disclose Dronach. And he got there by looking at documents about Conagher. I believe that alone was error because it's applying a should-have-known standard. There is no evidence, not documentary, not testamentary, that says that Mr. Fairclough or Mr. Harmond made the leap that the court found. The court found they should have made that leap, but there's no
evidence. But nothing requires a smoking gun or an admission. I mean, a finding of intent to deceive. I mean, it's all based on circumstantial evidence. So what's the problem with looking at the context and looking at all the evidence and looking at the context of what these people were thinking or doing at the time? Are you saying that's legally improper?
No, I think you can look at the context, but here the context is a direct analysis of Dronach by Mr. Fairclough, stating in some detail his view about why it was not material. And the discussion of Conagher was 2 years earlier by Mr. Harmon. It was a letter from Mr. Harmon to Mr. Fairclough, and we would encourage you to look at the entire document. That is A2366. There is one sentence that says it could be a problem, and then there's two paragraphs explaining why it's not actually going to be a problem and how Conagher is not really a problem in getting a patent. And then they disclosed Conagher to the patent office. So Conagher was disclosed. And then there is nothing tying any analysis of Conagher to any thoughts about Dronach, which would get to subjective intent by Mr. Harmon or Mr. Fairclough. And that leap is a should-have-known leap, which was improper under Kingsdown, and it's definitely improper under Therosense. And there was not an evidentiary basis in this record define subjective belief by anyone that Dronach was material or subjective decision by anyone to withhold it with intent to deceive the patent office.
Is willful blindness sufficient to establish intent?
I think if there was evidence of willful blindness, that would be some evidence of intent. Here, it's exactly the opposite. There are numerous documents in which Mr. Fairclough asked to get a copy of the Dronach patent, talks to his patent lawyer about it, analyzes the substance, deals with the substance. There is nothing in this record which would support willful blindness. I think if there was, for example, don't tell me about that, it could be a problem kind of evidence, I don't think that would get you there. And when Mr. Fairclough had such a strong view about what his invention was and that it was a weight between the initial wheelbases, not a three-wheelbase object, you can't get to an equitable conduct that way on this record. And if you look at a reference, consider a reference, analyze a reference, talk to your patent lawyer about a reference, conclude it's very different, and that constitutes an equitable conduct, the plague is going to continue. I'd like to briefly address the 102 and 103 issues. I think I can't agree with Mr. Carter on one issue, and that is that issue is ripe. If you vacate the inequitable conduct decision, there still needs to be a decision because that inequitable conduct would become moot if claim one is invalid. And the question of whether it is valid is fully decided, ruled on, and briefed.
Well, it doesn't become moot automatically. It becomes moot, I guess, as a practical matter based on what the party's representing, but not automatically. As a matter of law, doesn't it?
I don't think it's automatic, but it's here to be decided. And even if inequitable conduct is vacated, the case can be resolved. We obviously believe the finding of validity should be affirmed, and that issue should not continue to hang over our heads, if you will, even if the inequitable conduct finding is vacated.
Mr. Carter argues that since the platform in Dronach is rigidly attached, that the caster at the back end of that platform becomes the rear wheel. Why is that wrong?
It's wrong. I believe you're talking about the anticipation issue.
Yes.
And
It was relevant to obviousness as well.
It is, but we absolutely believe that you'd have to change the claim construction to get to anticipation, and there was conflicting testimony. Dronic itself, if you look at it, indicates that the platform attachment can be attached to the stroller more than one way. So we don't dispute that it might be rigid in some applications, but it was definitely not attached rigidly as a clear result from Dronic, and our expert testified it could be either way.
Well, what difference does it make if it can be attached different ways?
I don't think it makes any difference.
As long as the reference discloses a rigid attachment, that's prior art.
Well, it discloses both, and I don't think whether it's attached rigidly or not rigidly changes whether the caster wheel would be the rear wheels of the stroller. So under the court's claim construction, it's simply not an anticipating reference. If you change it, and there's substantial evidence in the record to support the finding of no anticipation under that claim construction. So I would completely disagree with Mr. Carter that you could essentially reweigh the evidence under the existing claim construction and find that it anticipates. Dronic's statement itself may not be dispositive as to what the rear wheel was, but it's certainly evidence that the jury could have relied on, for example. Testimony of our expert to the same effect, others to the same effect, is more than sufficient evidence for the jury to have relied on. And with respect to obviousness, again, the question is there substantial evidence in the record to support the jury's finding affirmed by Judge Ferguson? We know that obviousness is a mixed question of fact and law. The question was submitted under general verdict to the jury, and if there's substantial evidence in the record to support it, it needs to be affirmed. There's very substantial evidence in the record that this invention was not obvious. Dramatic commercial success. There was testimony from Baby Trends witnesses that the license and putting this product in their product line, quote, put them on the map. There was testimony from those in the industry at the time that it was contrary to industry thinking to design something this way, and so on. And I'm definitely out of time, and I appreciate your indulgence. Unless you have any questions, I'll...
Thank you, Mr. Storm. Carter, you consumed your time, but we'll give you a minute of rebuttal because we allowed Mr. Storm to go over a minute.
Very good. And I'm happy to answer any additional questions you have in that 1 minute. I didn't have a chance to touch on obviousness. I believe that the facts in this case compel a finding of obviousness. Judge Ferguson, his only hold up on the obviousness finding was that of motivation. He made it clear that it would have been a person of ordinary skill in the art would have found claim one obvious in view of Dronic, but he did not find motivation. However, this case is very much like KSR, the Wires case from this court, the Ball Aerosol case from this court, as cited in our briefing. It's a very simple mechanical device. We have a level of skill.
Neither
in the
KSR, art. Those dealt much with secondary considerations. How would you deal with those?
Well, in this case, the prima facie case of obviousness could not be any higher. When you have such a simple design, a very high skill level, mechanical
engineer. Jury didn't find it?
I'm sorry?
Jury didn't find it?
Jury did not find obviousness? Correct. They did not. However, in this case, this court, for example, in the Wires case, has reversed a jury verdict finding of non-obviousness based on these facts. When you have such a simple design, such a small change, if any, compared to the prior art, and to address your question on secondary considerations, as set forth in the Graham case from the U.S. Supreme Court, when the change from the prior art is so small, and the platform with a child being able to stand on it behind a sitting child, that is the difference that they say that results in the secondary considerations. That those secondary considerations can easily be outweighed in view of such a strong prima facie case of obviousness.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. Our next case is